I'm very happy now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Philip Connors. He's a fire lookout in the Black Range of the Gila National Forest. He is the author of the book Fire Season, Field Notes from a Wilderness Lookout, which we talked about here on the Radio Cafe a few years ago. And he just wrote an article that recently appeared in Orion Magazine. It's called Beauty in the Burn, Fire and Rebirth in the Forest. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Oh, it's great to be back. Thanks.
Great to have you. Now, you are a fire lookout, and I always love having people on the air who do something that is so foreign to my own and experience and probably that of almost any of our listeners. What is that job? What are your days like? What do you do?
Well, the shortest way to put it is I get paid to sit and stare out the window all day, which is a very unusual job in the 21st century, but I live and work on a mountaintop. I spend about 8 hours a day in a fire lookout tower, keeping watch over a good portion of the Gila National Forest. And my main job is to call in wildfires as soon as they happen, to give fire managers as much latitude to respond to them as possible. So, you know, I'm keeping watch during lightning storms. I'm keeping watch during high fire danger when it's really windy and dry. And aside from that, I'm also there as a communication relay for crews on the ground, whether they be fire crews or trail crews or what have you. Just sort of watching weather for them, being that relay if they can't talk to a dispatcher directly. I'll pass messages back and forth for them. And then every day I also take weather measurements at 9 a.m. and report, you know, precip and temperature and relative humidity and so forth. So watching for fires, relaying messages, and keeping an eye on weather are my main responsibilities.
How does one get trained for that job, and how did you come to it?
Well, I think it was Edward Abbey who said you could train any literate anthropoid with an IQ of about 80 to be a fire lookout in approximately an hour. I was given about a 15-minute crash course my first day on the job, and then sort of left to my own devices to figure it out. There's not much in the way of training. You have to be able to use something called an Osborne Firefinder, which is a sort of archaic instrument that's a sort of astrolabe. It basically allows you to get a bead on a fixed location from your fixed location and express it as a sort of compass bearing. That helps you draw a line between your location and the location of a fire. Ideally, then another lookout can see it as well, and you can just triangulate your lines on a map, thereby pinpointing the precise location of the fire. You have to, you know, be able to know which end of the binoculars to look through and how to read a map and how to operate a simple two-way radio. And that's about it, frankly. It's a pretty simple job.
And yet, as we know from people like Edward Abbey and Jack Loeffler and some of the people who are part of the great literary tradition of fire lookouts, it's also really profound.
Yeah, well, you have all this time on your hands. That was the attractive thing about the job to me in the beginning was, you know, I thought I wanted to be a writer, and here this job fell into my lap where it seemed I was basically being offered a paid writing retreat. And it turned out to be that and a whole lot more because I live and work inside of a wilderness area, which is a rare luxury. And I get to spend a lot of time just observing weather and wild creatures and sort of trying to find my way into the nature of this place that's very dynamic and very wild still. And with all that time on your hands, you know, your mind is free to roam, and I feel free to be creative when I'm there, and that's still one of the things that's very attractive about it for me is just that huge expanse of time in which to read and write and let my mind wander into unexpected places, all while, you know, essentially multitasking by simply keeping watch out the window and making sure nothing's starting on fire.
Yeah, I mean, do you ever, like, forget to look out the window?
You know, it's been known to happen. I recall one incident in one of my earliest seasons. I've been doing this for 14 years now. When I was kind of immersed in this book by William Kittredge, and I just sort of lost track of time, and all of a sudden I thought, I haven't looked out the window for probably half an hour. I look up, and there's a big plume of smoke rising up out of the Members Valley. So I, you know, quickly put my book down and got a sighting on it, and felt a little chagrined that I had probably been late by, who knows, 5 or 10 minutes calling in this fire. There weren't any terrible repercussions because of that. But, yeah, you just have to kind of always keep in the back of your mind the fact that there is a reason I'm here, and I have to stay alert and do this job, you know, not fall asleep and take a nap when the wind is blowing 50 miles an hour.
Right. I find it fascinating that with all the high-tech equipment and sensors in this world, the most effective early fire detectors are people perched on mountains.
Yes. You will find people who talk quite a bit about how we're destined to be obsolete before too long. People talk about, maybe high-tech motion detection sensors mounted on those towers that, you know, cameras pointed in every direction, satellite imagery that would offer an opportunity to spot a smoke for somebody watching a screen in an office somewhere. Of course, some places already use aerial flyovers. Some people dream of doing it even more cheaply with drones. But none of that technology is quite there yet to surpass the simple tool of a human being with two eyes open looking out the window and spotting a smoke. We are still very cheap, much cheaper than aerial surveillance, and for that reason they still use 10 of us actually on the Gila National Forest. So yeah. 10 of us making $13 an hour, that's $130 an hour, and you have pretty much full coverage of a 3.3 million acre forest.
Right.
Maybe someday they'll find a way to do it cheaper with a drone. I don't know. But until that time, I intend to cling to this job as strongly as possible.
Now, New Mexico forests are adapted to fire because we are, you know, we're dry country. I'm not sure that, like, the Pacific Northwest or northeastern forests burn the way ours do. But what does it mean for a forest to be adapted to fire? How does that work?
Well, the simplest way to put it is that, you know, in a dynamic ecosystem where things are growing and dying, there's going to be a fuel buildup over time unless it's wet enough for the fuel to rot, like which happens, say, on the Olympic Peninsula of Washington State, where they get 140 inches of rain a year.
Right.
An old tree dies and topples in the forest, and it's so wet there that that tree will almost immediately begin to decompose with the aid of moisture. Whereas in our landscape, as you point out, that does not happen. We're very arid. Even in the high country of the Gila, we get maybe 25 inches of precipitation a year. So, the way nature keeps its equilibrium is to burn that accumulated biomass. And so combine the aridness of the landscape with a propensity for lightning during our summer monsoons, and you have a place that is going to burn, has always burned. And that's a fact we sort of belatedly recognized in the 20th century after many decades of trying to fight every single fire.
And thus, the saying that a biologist once told you, there's no such thing as a bad fire.
Right. He was basically trying to say that, yeah, we have human-imposed categories in our mind of what's a good fire and what's a bad fire, but on the landscape, a fire doesn't really recognize those categories. All it recognizes is ignition sources, whether it's a careless human hand or a lightning strike, and then a combination of fuel conditions and weather. And if it's hot and dry and there's a lot of available fuel, then a fire will probably be large and hot. And if it's not so dry or the weather cools off and becomes more humid, then maybe the fire will burn slowly or not very much at all. You could quibble with his assessment and note that over the 20th century we put out so many fires that we changed the natural conditions of these forests, making, you know, these fires hotter and bigger than they might have been otherwise. But
yeah,
I think his larger point was that, you know, fire is sort of a reset on a landscape if it's allowed to burn. And that's been happening here for thousands and thousands of years. It wasn't until the early 1900s when we set up the national forests that we sort of parachuted into these landscapes and said, all right, we're going to banish fire because it's bad for the forest. Well, that turned out to be a terrible mistake.
You know, the fires, I mean, we've talked about this on this program a number of times before. I mean, you know, the landscape is adapted to fire. It regenerates when the charcoal from the fire that burns the trees actually adds minerals to the ground. There's a lot of advantages that come from fire. But then here in New Mexico, I mean, we've had fires in recent years that burned so hot because the forests hadn't been allowed to burn for too long that they destroyed the soil itself so that nothing will grow at all for many years to come, and it'll erode or flood out. And, I mean, that's not a regenerative fire anymore.
Right. That's where you could take issue with the idea that there's no such thing as a bad fire. But then part of it, too, has to do with just our changing climate. You know, we thought we were putting out fires during the 20th century, and we thought what we were doing was preserving timber and keeping the watershed stable and all of that, when, in fact, we weren't putting them out. We were just putting them off until a later time. And I think the longer you put them off, and the more fuel buildup you get in those landscapes, the higher risk you run of a big, hot, really damaging fire. And especially, yeah, in northern New Mexico, that's what we've seen in the last decade. So it's a tricky thing. I would not want to be a fire manager under current conditions. I'm really lucky because I just get to sit literally and figuratively above it all and watch them make the hard decisions about which fires to fight and which fires to let burn. And increasingly, we see fires that really just can't be fought. They quickly grow in size, and they get moving, and to put firefighters in the way of them would just be suicidal madness. So,
well, I mean, you describe a fire in which you saw the fire, you saw it start to burn, you went through all the steps that you go through, and it just got bigger and hotter, and you actually had to be evacuated by helicopter. I mean, that's scary stuff. I mean, What's that like? I mean, do you feel like you're in danger? Was it scary?
You know, I didn't feel in immediate danger when that happened, but it was obvious that the fire was beyond anyone's control and that it was more than likely going to reach my location at some point. So my bosses just made the decision to get me out of there early and not risk, you know, having me stay there till the last possible minute, in part because my vehicle was parked at a trailhead sort of between my mountain and the fire, and they wanted the truck out of the way. So it was a sinking feeling, really, to be evacuated by helicopter from the country over which I'd been keeping watch. Because once that happened, it really became clear, well, there is nothing I can do here anymore, and this fire is out of everybody's control, and it'll stop when nature dictates. So it was a sort of melancholy trip out in that helicopter, looking down on this landscape from above and realizing it was about to be transformed forever. And when I came back, it would not look the same.
What is it like to go back after a fire?
It's complicated, you know, because if you spend as much time as I had spent in that country, you know, a dozen years, you grow attached to it. You grow attached to the way it looks and feels and smells. And when you go back after it's burned, and that fire burned 200 square miles, of which, you know, I was basically in the center of the eventual burn scar. So everything around my remote duty location had been changed somehow. And it was a bit of a shock to go back and to see the magnitude of the changes, because I had become attached to the way it was. I liked to think that I had a certain ecological awareness of the necessity of fire in a healthy fire-adapted ecosystem, but then to actually see that in reality was shocking and disturbing, and it took me a little while of being there afterwards to slowly begin to make my peace with the fact that, well, henceforth I would be watching a dynamic landscape sort of heal itself over time, and that's been really interesting. But at first it was, at first I felt myself to be sort of grieving for what had been lost there.
Yeah, I know. It's in a way that kind of forest regeneration, I was thinking as I was reading your article, serves as a metaphor for the kind of losses and regenerations that we have in our own lives in a way.
Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah, I've suffered losses in my own life, as we all do, the loss of people we love, people dear to us. And those losses, you know, are felt as a wound at first, which over time becomes a scar that heals in some fashion, but transforms us. And I think all of that holds true for a forest fire as well. It's a wound at first. Watersheds get disrupted. A certain, you know, tree type that may have been there for hundreds of years is suddenly gone in a stand replacement plume of smoke. But it's not a wound that stays unhealed forever. You know, the first little bit of rain and all of a sudden you have green things poking up through the char. So,
and you have tree frogs.
Yes, and you come back to your mountain after the fire and you're startled to find a mountain tree frog in the meadow of the top of your mountain, and you think to yourself, geez, maybe the life of this place will go on in some healthy and interesting way, even though it has burned. That was a really cool moment, coming back and finding this little frog. I had heard them a couple of times over the years, but I'd never been able to actually find the source of the croaking. And oddly enough, my first hour back after the fire, I saw this little mountain tree frog, and it was really kind of a neat omen.
So when you go back after a fire, I mean, was in that case, was your lookout, was your equipment and the place where you lived and everything, was that all destroyed, or did it remain intact?
Yeah, it remained intact, in part because the decision had been made to light some fire from a helicopter around the mountaintop before the main body of the fire reached that location, so that when it did get there, it would run out of fuel, essentially. So they burned off some grass in a kind of irregular circle around the mountaintop, and that preserved the actual mountaintop pretty much untouched on top. It looked almost the same as it ever had when I got back there, which was surprising and heartening. You know, you walked a couple hundred yards in any direction and you saw pretty black scorch, but due to that decision to do a little burnout up there ahead of the fire, my cabin, my tower, everything was unharmed, thankfully.
So then you're a fire lookout again in the same place where there was a fire. Do you have anything to look out for? I mean, are there other parts of the fire that weren't burned and then that's what you're looking for?
You know, inside the burn scar, there are some islands of green. One thing I've noticed over the years down here on the Gila is that fires really do burn with varying intensities. And so even within the same fire, there will be places that really burn hot, places that hardly burn at all, and little islands and fingers of untouched green. So those still exist and could still burn. And beyond the boundary of the burn scar, I can see, you know, lots of country that hasn't burned probably in 100 years. So in my immediate neighborhood, fire danger is pretty low. I mean, the Silver Fire, the fire we're talking about from a couple years ago, was a massive fuel reduction project. And now my concern is sort of beyond the outlines of that.
Do you get lonely?
Almost never. And I suppose that partially just comes with practice being alone. You know, like everything, if you practice enough at it, you get good. And I've spent, you know, 100 days a year alone on that mountaintop for 14 years now. So I'm pretty comfortable in my own skin. Every once in a while, it'd be nice to exercise my vocal cords with, you know, a day hiker or something, and no one will show up for 6 or 8 days, and I won't have that opportunity. But I really like being alone, and just having the time to read and write and study maps and look at the country. And it turns out there's plenty to do there to keep yourself busy. And you learn this over the years by necessity, essentially.
Philip Connors is a fire lookout in the Black Range of the Gila National Forest. He is the author of the book Fire Season, Field Notes from a Wilderness Lookout, which we talked about here on the Radio Cafe several years ago. I think you can probably go back in the archives on SantaFeRadioCafe.org and find that show. And he recently wrote an article for Orion Magazine titled Beauty in the Burn, Fire and Rebirth in the Forest. I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.